Good evening, friends. Welcome back to the Front Porch. My name is Dennis Rogers, and I am joined by Michael Daniels. How's it going, Mike? How was your alternate Monday?
Pretty fantastic, Dennis. We are recording right after a crazy celestial event.
Yeah, so. I was also going to say that we are recording on alternate Monday, which is the way that we describe Wednesday almost all of the time, because on Monday, our regularly scheduled recording day, the world ended for 4 minutes.
Yes. So I'm having this hard time living through the apocalypse right now. Mm-hmm, so I want to say it's a good alternate Monday, but there's demons outside my house right now. So I think I've got the house secured, but if I scream out in the middle, then
I've had multiple versions of this conversation over the past 3 days. Well, not really today, but actually I did. I talked to one of my Discord friends who lives in like Minnesota or something, who was just, he could just see like partially, wasn't in the totality, but could see, like the sky get darker. I was in, some of my family went down to Tennessee, last time that a total eclipse, went through the U.S. That was 2017. We were down in Tennessee, and I think we were on the edge of it because I don't think it lasted as long as this one, but it still was complete. And my brother-in-law was with us, and I saw him yesterday when I got back from Bloomington, and he said that it was cloudy. Like, I couldn't remember really seeing the corona like we did this time, and we got all the other effects, though, right? So anybody listening to this is probably either saw it themselves or is sick of hearing about it by now. But
sure, I believe that.
It's one of those things, like, I'd seen it before, and so I knew what to expect, or it was like that thing where I rewatch a movie that I've seen where I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot that this happens, and then this happens. Like, you remember the scenes just as they happened. The thing that I remember most vividly from last time is the orange glow, like a sunrise or sunset, but in every direction, right? You never see that. There's no, could see sunrise, you could see sunset, but they're at opposite sides of the sky. This is everywhere in every direction. We watched it from Trotsky's front yard, where there are a decent amount of trees. Like, the trees aren't have no leaves. Right. So that only slightly hindered us. But we could not see, we could see a lot of the horizon, but not all of it, which was a little disappointing, but we didn't have a great alternative unless we wanted to like go downtown, or a lot of plans went back and forth. And the consensus generally was like, let's not go anywhere. Let's just stay here and watch it here. It'll be fine. As I mentioned, I couldn't see the corona last time, which is just like you spend, I don't know, like an hour using those glasses and watching this like sliver of the moon overlap the sun very gradually, until it turns into a crescent. That crescent gets smaller and smaller. And then the whole time I'll come back to that. As soon as that happens, you can take the glasses off and you can look where the sun was, right? It's obviously still there, but you look and you don't see the sun. You see what looks like a special effect from a sci-fi movie.
100%. To add to your first part, I want you to continue with this description, but I think it's important. I didn't know about the sunglasses there because they're not sunglasses, but these eclipse glasses, for those who didn't go through this and don't know, and they're not like sunglasses. They don't darken things around you. It's completely black. It's like wearing black blindfold over your head, except for this yellow orange circle. Yes. Right. So what you're seeing up to where you're just describing, Dennis, I'm saying this to the listeners, you see just black while looking through these glasses with that little thing. And then, so when it goes out, like the total eclipse, you're looking at just blackness.
Yeah.
And then Dennis describes what, now you see this in CG, I think.
Yeah, you take it off. And so the other things that I sort of remembered as they were happening, like we were sitting outside, some of the guys were playing, what's the game Trotsky loves? Condottiere. Yeah. I had the dog with me on a leash, and so I was like, I don't want to deal with playing a game in the tent. I'll sit out here and drink a beer. It'll be fine. But as it started to happen, as the moon blocked, you know, about 25 to 50% of the sun, once it got to a certain point, I started to notice it and pointed it out to the group there. It starts to get dark, but not dark in a normal way, right? Not dark like nighttime gets dark. Like, there are still, like, solid shadows, right? And you can see the sky around is still blue. It's still bright blue, like midday, because it is midday. It was midday. It was
That's the best thing right there, the description of it, is that it's blue and not like sunset when it starts to get darker.
Right,
like changes color.
Normally, when night falls, the sky gets dark, and the sky did darken, but much more subtly than it normally does. And so I pointed that out. Pointed out how the shadows get less. Like when we first went outside, I had sunglasses on, and for a while I was putting the eclipse glasses over my sunglasses, and then at a certain point I took my sunglasses off because I didn't need them anymore. It wasn't that bright. And the temperature drops. Like, you can feel the air get cooler, like, by the minute as it's happening. And it, like, it's this build up. And then it happens, and everything, like, it's like dusk. Everything is very dark. Like, you can still see, but just looking up at the corona, that was the new part of this experience for me that I hadn't experienced before. And there were a couple I can't take. Well, one of the things I'll say that, you know, I said several times in talking about this, absolutely 100% can believe how, I don't know, however many centuries ago before we understood astronomy and understood what is actually happening in an eclipse, that people would have thought this was something supernatural or divine, right?
Yes. Like, fully. Yes.
I think I mentioned this last week, right? Like, you know, we pissed off, or Mercury pissed off Zeus and he's getting punished, or, you know, something wild is happening up there. And I said that to somebody in one of the, cause I've had, again, variations of this conversation at least half a dozen times since. But somebody I was talking to said, I absolutely believe that because, I think it was, Pete's partner, Liz, she was making a video that she was going to send to her family. And as soon as it happened, you know, like swore, like, holy, shocked, like, you know, beyond words where the epithet just came out. And whoever it was in this conversation said, I absolutely believe that because earlier today, when we were having this conversation Monday, like, we understand what's happening. We know that the sun is this and the moon is, you know, the right distance that we can see. This is the thing I was talking about last week. Like, we understand exactly what's happening. Like, we don't even have to be scientists. Like, it's not that complicated. Like, the orbit, sort of the plane, the orbit plane between Earth and the sun, gesturing with my hands, and the moon revolves around the Earth at a different plane, at a different angle.
Yeah.
And so those have to align so that the path of the moon, or the plane of the moon's orbit, crosses the plane of Earth's orbit around the sun at the same time that, you know, we're looking at the sun and, you know, the moon crosses, but like all those things have to align. But all those things align, and it's just the moon revolving or rotating, whichever those
or revolving. Yeah. You're right. Yeah.
Is it revolve?
Yeah, because it revolves around something. Rotate, is it spinning? Right.
See, I thought about, I think
you're,
it's,
you're
I,
our wordsmith here.
Yeah, so. I think it's the other way because an engine has revolutions per minute. It's revolving. Whatever.
Okay.
The Earth, the moon is moving between Earth and the sun. Like, that part of it is not complicated. Like, we, you know, your average person in grade school science, like, learns what that means. And still, understanding that, we're just blown away, amazed. Like, this is not, this is not real. This is not a thing. Like, it's both, I think it was Peter who said, it's somehow both scientific and natural, right? Like, it's a natural phenomenon that we understand through science, and that's, you know, science is how we understand the natural world. But, like, at both ends, like, this is, like, it's both supernatural and incredibly natural, right? Like, it's weird.
That's where it was. Yeah, it's natural and supernatural, right? Yeah.
Yeah,
I agree that it's hard to explain, and this is why it's worth talking about, I think, even having this discussion, because it's before me and now after me, like, or before eclipse me and after eclipse me type thing. Like, I understand not thinking it's that big of a thing. I mean, not that big a thing. I really, really liked eclipses in general, just like partial eclipses and things.
Sure, yeah.
I think they're super neat. I love astronomy, space.
Do the weird just, shadow thing. And
yeah, I think it's freaking neat, our universe, right? Everything about it, I just eat up all the time. Super sci-fi nerd or just science nerd with space and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's cool, but it's not like it's a life-changing event or whatever, and or perspective-changing. But I think this one was a moment, now having experienced, well, I've said to people, this is worth traveling for. This is worth getting on a plane and flying to a place to experience it, which before Eclipse Me would have said, that makes no sense. I'm really glad we have people flying in just so we can hang out all together. But for the eclipse just seems like kind of a lame excuse. And now that I've experienced it, no, that seems like that's the reason to do it. And the other stuff with hanging out with friends and stuff is the extra. Because having kind of lived through that and had the experience that you just described of this is an alien world and everything has changed because we just don't know from our moment of birth to where we are in life now, how normal day night cycle is. We have differences in cloud cover and rain when it happens. But still the light that we have on Earth is a constant all the time.
Right.
And when we don't have it, we live with artificial light all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when the entire world around you, the light changes fundamentally, it's your body just doesn't know what to think about it. And I know that, like, the natural world as well, like birds and bumblebees and a lot of creatures of the world actually react to the eclipse in odd ways,
right?
Which is an interesting to go ahead thing look up in Google if anybody's interested. But so it really affects us. And then when I was in it, when that happened, my first thing was like, that's the weirdest. It's just like seeing a CGI. It was a split moment of taking my glasses down and seeing a movie over the eclipse of some kind of sci-fi thing. Yeah. Right. And then my head goes down to look at the world around me. And it's just like, what? I don't understand. The sky is a nighttime dark blue with full around horizon, because I could see around. I didn't have a lot of trees around. I mean, there's trees, but nothing blocking the views. Mm-hmm. And seeing that sunset on the horizon, kind of, but the sun is fully there and the blue sky and the lights were on in the houses around me. And it was just stunning, stunning. And it winked out. Like, it just winked out. It went from when people say, don't go to, it's not worth traveling to a 90%. Only total eclipse matters, and I absolutely agree. The 100% is the only thing that matters.
Yeah, that was a thought I had in my mind when I started talking, because people say, like, you know, you hear these anecdotes, and that's a thing. After last time I was in Bloomington, and I think it was Betsy, our friend Mike Trotsky's wife, she said she heard on the radio or whatever people saying, like, you know, if you if you don't live, if you're going to travel, it's only worth traveling if you get to totality. And I had just experienced totality, and I was like, okay, sure, that makes sense. But if you're outside of totality, so that all the only effect you get is that crescent over the sun that you can look at through the glasses or through the shadow box thing, like, that's cool. But there's no real difference between, like, seeing part of that shadow and seeing a lot of that shadow, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's still just that shadow. If you're not in that path, in that range, where it's completely blocked out and you can look up and see the corona and see everything dark and see and feel the temperature drop, and then over the next hour, like, feel it warm back up to normal and have that, like, I think somebody in our group was like, huh, I guess we really do need the sun. Like, yeah. Obviously we all know that, but
right.
to sit outside and have that reality, not reality, have that fact made real to you in a present, like,
quick amount of time.
Tangible
we
way.
The temperature at night and day.
Right,
we know
right.
that temperature.
Right. And you know that, like, oh, it cools down at night, depending on where you live, unless you live in one weird place that stays hot all night, like the Midwest. But to have that, like, oh, as the sun is blocked out, it gets cold and it gets dark, and it happens pretty fast. And then to have it end and have the light and the warmth come back and to feel it, like, I'm struggling to come up with an adjective for this. Like,
it's hard to explain. It really is. But it was so noticeable. I mean, we were sitting in recliner chairs, or like camp chairs that mm-hmm. recline back on my back deck, and looking up, and we were basically suntanning, you know, just mm-hmm. kind of standing with our glasses on up and into the sky. And unlike suntanning, where you're just kind of always looking up in one direction, we were literally following the every inch of the sun as it goes through. But we're sweating. We can feel the burn. We had to go get suntan lotion to put on so that we didn't get just a face burn with a stripe across our eyes. And it's hot. I was sweating. I was really sitting there hot, and I was in shorts and stuff.
Yeah.
Then when it goes away, I was chilly, you know? It's like,
yeah. Yeah.
So
and
cold.
It's worth mentioning also that we had basically ideal weather.
Oh my gosh. Like, it's not been ideal since. It's been like stupid rain in before and after, but for one day.
I went outside when I made dinner before we started recording and took the dog out so she could go, and it's just been like all day today. It's Wednesday now. It's alternated between drizzling and brief kind of legitimate showers that last like 5 minutes, and just gray, and the rain never completely stops. And I'm like, oh, I forgot that it's like this in Indiana in the spring. And it was pretty cold and overcast almost every other day. And probably like Sunday was okay, and yesterday wasn't quite as bad. But Monday, it was just sunny and beautiful and clear sky. And I don't think that was the case. It definitely wasn't on the whole path. And then I saw some weather reports, like my friend in Wisconsin said, it was just cloudy. So he couldn't even really see the crescent thing through the glasses because there's so much cloud cover.
We were just really lucky, really lucky how perfect it was. I want to go back to something about like the experience of it when, so we're watching it like by the second, you have all have our glasses on. We're almost like counting down as it gets, the slice gets thinner and thinner and thinner. Yeah. So it's just a dot. And, you know, I had my glasses down and looking around the world just at normal at something, you know, like, I don't know, getting a drink or whatever. And the world is, it's definitely darker. Like you said, it's getting darker, but it's still yellow sun with even just like a sliver. It's still like normal kind of light colors.
Yeah.
And then as soon as it winks out, like it winks out, you drop your glasses down and the sun is a different color because it's white. It's black and white, not yellow or, you know, the sun color, it's black and white. And you're like, why is it all of a sudden, you know, that immediate change is just insane how that works. And it's like an instant, it's just a flicker of a second. And then it's when you get that flash, right? And then the moment it comes back, like it just goes out of totality, that 1 second, boom, everything's got the yellow sun, blue sky again, with just a dot of light being covered, not covered. And like, so literally that 99% totality or eclipse is nothing when the experience, when you get 100%, because then it just, the world, it flickers like a switch. My sister said it's like someone turned on a corner light, you know, a light in the corner, like of a lamp. Mm-hmm. And things change. I'm like, wow, that's very appropriate. So anyway, we talked a lot about the eclipse, but it's really worth talking about because it's super, super cool.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, I think the next time the total eclipse crosses the U.S. is going to be like 20 years from now.
Yeah, and it's only like partial. I think it's like the northern part of Montana.
It won't be full here, but there's one, I think one in like 44 that will cross Montana. And then like in 45, there's one that goes from west to east. Is that right? I don't know. It's crossing the country. Yeah, I guess it maybe would be west to east. I don't know how the moon's orbit goes. And there's some like next year or the year after that'll be in Europe, like in Spain and Egypt, and maybe one in Iceland or something. It's worth seeing at least once, as our buddy Fox said after it happened. It's really indescribable. Like you can talk about it, you can describe it, you can see photos and videos, but there's really nothing like being in it and experiencing it. It's like I don't know, somewhere in something you were describing earlier. It's a little bit like being a kid and experiencing something for the first time, and obviously. Maybe not obviously, but you know, as an adult, you can travel and you can see things you've never seen. You can see the Grand Canyon. You can see Yosemite, as I did last year. But you know, you're a kid and you see like a city for the first time, or you know, maybe you grew up somewhere where there aren't thunderstorms and you move somewhere and you hear thunder and lightning for the first time, or something like that. But this was like the sci-fi thing. It would be like if aliens showed up, right? Ship, right? Like you see that in like Independence Day and stuff, where the ship flies over and it blocks out the sun. But you know, that not something we're ever likely to experience in real life. And yeah, so if you have an opportunity, it's worth. I don't know if I would fly to Europe, to experience it. And as I said, unfortunately, the next one in the U.S. is quite a few years away. But
it's definitely. I think it was. If I had never seen it in my life, and our long talk here, like you said, people are getting sick of it. But one of the reasons I kind of wanted to talk about this to get this out is that. For those who was like the before eclipse, Michael, think it's silly. Like I honestly will say it's worth spending a moderate amount of money to travel, to go see, you know, and make it happen so that maybe once in your life you get to see it. So those who are, I don't know, 20 years old now and listening in 44, they'll be in their 40s. Plan it, do it. If you miss it now, like no big deal, man. Don't miss out on another opportunity to go have the experience and see that very sci-fi thing. The last thing I want to say on this topic was also, if people haven't seen at least the one video that you should watch about the eclipse to go online, is the one where I think it's from like SpaceX Starlink satellite. They've got of the shadow of the moon crossing the Earth.
Oh, from space. And yeah. I've seen
from that. Space. Yeah. It is like a black hole on the Earth. It's It's just almost as freaky as when you're watching in the eclipse on the ground of this thing happening. Again, you said, we know what's happening here. It's just a shadow. But holy cow, does it look weird.
Yeah.
A black sci-fi black hole is eating our planet going across it. It's like, wow, that's freaky wild. And actually, when I was watching it, the thing I kept thinking is like, whoever directed this should have zoomed out further so we can see a better shot. You know, tell me, it's a literal thing from space, you crazy man. But I one thing I'm surprised I didn't see more of on my TikTok feed or on anything is, you know, how conspiracy theorists lose their minds at this kind of stuff. And I'd love to hear their goofy thoughts. Oh. Just to laugh at them.
Yeah. What are the flat earthers think is happening?
I don't. Yeah. They have like reasons, right? They explain it because they try to explain everything away. So surely the eclipse has to be on their list,
right?
For flat earther people. Okay. Anyway, moving along. Hey, did you see that new Joker 2 trailer that they put out? It's not coming out till October, but they got one.
I mean, I watched it when you sent it to me because I never saw the first movie, so I'm not.
Oh, you didn't? Okay. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. Maybe we'll put it on the list. We probably should put it on the list before the other movie comes out. I think the first movie is worth watching. It's definitely not a, I know the Joker from watching the Batman movies, or I know the Joker from, no, it's not none of that. Like none of it. It's just none of that. It's its really own movie. And it's like the concept of who the Joker is, like from a feelings perspective.
Sure.
Or a psychological perspective. And they make that happen. Which I found pretty good. Obviously the Academy Awards did as well. I think the first one is worth watching. It is one that I will watch once. I said once in my life, but I'll probably watch it twice because we'll watch it for the show. Not because it's bad, just because I saw it. Like I experienced the thing. I saw it. I got the impact. And that was that. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's the thing for the first one. The second one looks to be more of that. More of the same, but with Harley being in it. I think the trailer looks, and it's got musical stuff in it. So I read something about
at least
the director.
At least the trailer pitches it as a musical. It's not another one of those secret musicals like Wonka or
True.
The other one was.
Well, I don't actually think it's a musical because our buddy Fox kind of made that comment that it's going to be a musical. And I thought, and I, after watching the trailer, I'm like, oh crap, it is. The way the director kind of describes it is that music plays a heavy role in it. He didn't say it wasn't a musical, but he also says that there are musical pieces where it's the music is the center of it. And I think what that means is that, and you can see it in the trailer, is where there's like a whole song played and they're dancing on the rooftop and the music drives the scenes. So it's like,
so it's,
I don't think they're singing like in a musical.
Sure.
You know,
maybe, I mean, obviously Lady Gaga is a singer. But if it's,
that's very true. She's an awesome singer.
If
they could just use that, but
if it's not a musical, then this is just the opposite of the Wonka and whatever the other movie was that I can't remember right now. Like,
where they sell it as a musical?
Where the trailer seems like it's a musical, but it's not going to be. Like, what is wrong with people?
What is wrong with advertisers these days? I don't know. He did also, I want to repeat, he did not say it was not a musical. He didn't say it was, or didn't say it wasn't.
It's not a musical.
Yeah, so. But you know, the double negative seems to say it is, but it's not what he was saying, I think.
Right.
But who knows? I don't know. I would not want to see a musical out of this because of the first film. But it does look like it's more of the first film. But with Harley, and they didn't make Harley Quinn a psychologist. He's supposed to be his doctor that fell in love with him.
Right. But I mean, again, not seeing the first one. Isn't it really like the first one just completely not like inspired by the Joker?
Yeah, you're
inspired by the comics.
Yes, you're right. I guess I say that because the Joker as a character is an insane person who laughs and is chaos, right? Like, I guess core at his core. And you always wonder, like, he's so not real. He's so not a real person.
Sure.
Right? Like, completely comic fantasy type thing, but an interesting character nonetheless. And the first movie kind of takes the thing of, like, how could somebody get to be that? Sure. Like, really, like, in a real way, in a believable real way. And they did a fantastic job of it. So I would have loved to have seen, how does a educated, doctorate holding Harley Quinzel, Quinzel become this? And they didn't take that. I kind of said it in the chat that it feels like a missed opportunity for them to do that transition well.
For sure.
Instead, they're starting with her already being crazy like him, and then they're just two crazy people that fall in love and they complete each other. So they're clearly focusing on the love story part of it instead of her journey with it, which feels we just seen a trailer. We didn't see anything.
She could still be a former psychologist.
Psychologist, I think. Psychiatrist. Yeah, I don't know. I think one of those.
One of those. And, you know, is in Arkham for something else she did before meeting him.
True. I mean, she's Harley Quinn is an interesting character in the same way that the Joker is on her own. And I think that the recent Harley Quinn stuff with the cartoon, which was really great, mm-hmm. and like how she's breaking up with the Joker, it's all funny comedy, but still, you know, it kind of makes her own identity. And the DCEU or whatever, Harley Quinn with Suicide Squad with Margot Robbie, has done some good stuff of her being on her own, being her own character, the emancipation of one Harley Quinn with Birds of Prey. You know, I think they've done a good, this is her own character, but she's still kind of crazy like the Joker. It would have been great to see this kind of interpretation from it, but I'm okay. It'll be fine, I think. And Joaquin Phoenix is, I don't know what to think about that guy. I mean, obviously he's a good actor in the parts that he does, but he always feels disturbed anytime I watch him. He feels like I would be terrified of him in real life, like looking at him.
There's a role. Did you ever watch Walk the Line?
I didn't. I've heard great things about it and saw all the trailers and stuff.
Put that on the list for some point.
Mm-hmm. But I guess he did the same thing where he went fully into the part and became that person. It's Johnny Cash, right?
Yeah, it's Johnny Cash. Yeah, that's true.
Again, nothing against, you know, professional actors who were great and amazing. The method acting type of stuff feels weird to me, but again, it's not my profession. So,
sure.
But when I see interviews with him in real life, he seems like creepy and weird, just in general. And maybe that's why he was the Joker. So. Sure. I did also say that the show had me feel weird because they didn't like the source material or use the source material and weren't comic book people. He took the job. Joaquin Phoenix took the job only because it wasn't going to be like a comic book, and the director promised to not be a comic book movie in any way. And I was like, you've taken a comic book character and not making, okay. Bothered me a little bit.
I mean, it depends on what that means, right? Like, there was a time where we could clearly know what that means. Now we're living in an era of comic movie saturation, right?
Yeah, so, yeah.
You know, maybe that's but it is weird.
Not like it's X-Men like the cartoon, you know?
Right. Like, there is something weird about something. I mean, that was my complaint about Alex Kurtzman running Star Trek for Paramount, when, like, not only did he bring up the Trek Wars comparison, I don't know if that was him or the interviewer could have been the interviewer, because that's the stupid question people always want to ask. But identified himself more of a Star Wars guy. And I'm like, why did you put a guy who says he likes Star Wars better in charge of Star Trek? What? Like,
yeah, I get you.
You know, yeah. But, if you know, based on, and again, not having seen the original film, if you're trying to do a completely different, you know, new take on something, that's kind of what you want.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Yeah, and they weren't wrong, because it was a decent film, in my opinion. So, but we will make those judgment calls in a couple months when we watch it for the show.
Sure.
That was and what's the name? Folia Du or some kind of weird thing? But
Folia Du. It's French for, like, madness for two, or folly for two. Folly just a bit.
And they got the word two in there because it's not joke without saying Joker two, right?
Oh yeah, that's. I don't think I put
I love that how that you just dawned on you with that one.
I just immediately, because there's two, because it's love, right? It's yeah. Joker and Harley. I'm like, yeah, it's madness for two, like dinner for two.
Yeah. I didn't think about the
Joker part two.
Yeah. Two other things we talked about real quick. One, I'm just going to say, I finally got to watching He-Man Revelations. I know this isn't big for you, but any other listeners, it's the Kevin Smith. Kevin Smith ran Britain done show of He-Man on Netflix. It's the second season, I guess. They're not really doing seasons. They're kind of like limited series. So there's like one show called He-Man something, and then there's He-Man Revelations, and there's like, they're the same universe, same story type stuff, characters, but they're not like a series, I guess. But anyway, I wasn't a fan. I've been on record not being a fan of the first one. He went in clearly like, I'm going to take He-Man and make it a modern thing and just change it all to a modern stuff and make it a new reinterpretation of He-Man, and just was not popular by He-Man fans. I think it was the wrong thing to do. Go back and listen to my reviews about that one. This one does the opposite. Clearly he knew, and he's a big fan of He-Man. I mean, he's a super nerd, comic book nerd in of our age type stuff anyway.
Right.
And he had stuff about the feedback. It bothered him, but it didn't bother him, and et cetera, et cetera. But when he got greenlit for the second season, series, whatever it was, clearly he took this to heart, and this one is definitely feels like it's an old school He-Man. This feels like it's the right kind of He-Man, but done today. I mean, he even did in the last episode, the old school cartoon, the He-Man dialogue was super corny. He said like dad jokes constantly because it was a kid's show, right? And in the last episode, when He-Man is in it almost the entire episode, he's in it throughout the season, but it's all He-Man in this last season. He starts spouting dad jokes all the time, like really corny stuff. And I'm like, oh, it sounds corny, but that's intentional because that's how it was back in the day. And it's kooky. And he's writing this, and this film was made for fans of He-Man, finally, which he screwed up the first time not doing.
Right.
And if I could talk to him anything, he's obviously a great filmmaker that everybody loves. But I would say, man, I wish you could switch the seasons and make the first one your go, where you got everybody on board with this and changed a little stuff like he did. And because season two is not all nostalgia at all. It's definitely its own story. But if he had just done that and then got people on board with his characterizations of these characters, and then now change things in the second season, I think it would have been accepted a lot more. Oh, we got what we wanted. Build and then up, now we kind of, yeah.
Establish some trust.
That's right. That's a good phrase. Establish some trust with the viewers. And unfortunately, I know a lot of people that were He-Man fans aren't even given, which was me included, aren't giving the second season a chance because they're like, it just totally wrecked it for me.
Fool me once.
Not giving this again. Barely made it through the first season. That's unfortunate because this one just really, really fit everything. I rewatched the last episode again because it felt like such a good He-Man, you know, modern He-Man episode. So very cool. I liked it a whole lot. And I will watch it again.
Is that the show? I don't remember if I talked about this last time you talked about this series, but is that the show with Skeletor where he says something really unsettling and then runs off?
I have no idea. I don't remember that, but I believe it. I'm
sure I've said this before. This was not a show that I was allowed to watch as a kid, and so I have no knowledge or experience with it except for a few memes. That laughing video is probably super old internet meme, or the Power of Grayskull, or any of that kind of stuff. But
It's all about magic stuff.
Right? Yeah, magic sword and I don't know why it was objectionable to concerned parents in the 80s, but it was.
Magic. And there's a demon skeleton looking guy.
It's skeleton guy and whatever. But a couple months ago, I was getting TikToks that were just that Skeletor thing, where he'd say, remember, any machine can be a smoke machine if you operate it wrong enough.
Love this.
Until
yeah.
we meet again.
That was made into a book, by the way, and it's called like Skeletor Knows Best or something. Mm. And I bought that. It's on my coffee table right now. It's just a book full of those kind of things.
It seems like their version of the knowing is half the battle G.I. Joe thing.
Yes, 100%.
Which is another show that I didn't watch, but I don't think it was because we weren't allowed. It just maybe wasn't on at the right time. We didn't get that channel or whatever.
Maybe not your thing even, you know, sometimes.
Maybe, I don't know.
I will say that Kevin Smith, I mean, the one thing, number one apparent, which is almost never apparent for me, but was in this one, was the voice actors, was Kevin Smith having his dream people from his childhood play anything he wants. Like finally getting the ability to have Netflix money and say, can I cast anyone I want as voices? Okay, here we go. Because I'm gonna give you, list off the cast for this show. Melissa Benoist is Teela. Mm-hmm. She's like Supergirl.
Supergirl.
Meg Foster's Motherboard. Keith David is Hordak. Lena Headley is Evil-Lyn. William Shatner is Keldor. Mark Hamill is Skeletor. John DeLancey is another guy. Liam Cunningham, which is the guy from Game of Thrones, Man-at-Arms. And Dietrich Bader is King Randor. Oh, Tony Gott is Scarecrow. So, seriously, Google Master of the Universe Revolution cast, and then you look at those pictures, and you're like, oh, man, those are all people from the 80s and 90s, you know, that were real big. And a couple modern ones with, like, Lena Headley and Melissa and Liam in there. But, you know, when John DeLancey's voice comes up, you're like, he just got John DeLancey in there. Oh, Mark Hamill's there. Is that William Shatner? You know, all the voices that he could get, he did.
Yeah.
So I liked it. Thumbs up. Worth watching. They should have called He-Man Redemption because it just kind of redeemed the stuff. And it does have a little tag at the end, so that maybe they'll have a third season. And I would absolutely watch the third one now that I've gotten into it. Also, the animation is pretty freaking good. They just really took the things that people liked about the He-Man things and made it modern animation. Like, that's very cool. Also, they had a couple callbacks to the toys. Like, I remember there being Battle Armor He-Man, and if you pushed his chest, it flipped over and it showed like scars on the battle armor. And He-Man in battle gets this special armor, which is clearly the battle armor. And then when it gets hit, it literally flips over his chest just like the toy did. And I was like, well done, man. Like, you totally to us nostalgia freaks here.
Like Lego Movie, Lego Batman.
Yes, right. It's that kind of silliness. All right, that's enough of my individual thing watching. Can we talk about episode one of Shogun? Because now I'm actually watching the series.
Sure.
Well, I've been telling you for like a month now that I'm just going to watch it. And I know you've been watching it along.
Yeah, I have one episode I haven't seen that I think came out last night or something, but I'm otherwise caught up.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I've been wanting to watch this last month anyway. And this week I'm like, I am going to, when I have a day, and I had all the eclipse stuff happening, so it wasn't really having a lot of time, but I was we didn't record on Monday to Wednesday. I thought, okay, I am going to watch this thing on Tuesday for sure. And I didn't get to watch it until like, I don't know. I think I was texting you at 1 or 2 in the morning or something about it. Mm. But I was guaranteed to going to watch this thing. By the way, I did fit He-Man Revolutions in there, but that's half hour or 25 minute show on an actual five episode. Just giving my thing 5 episodes, okay. Which I watched like during dinner. So Shokan, I don't know if it's spoiler to say this, but man, episode 1, I am hooked. I'm on it. Like it is, it made me walk into the thing and pull out my samurai sword. I had just like, oh, cool, man. Just loved it. I think the message I sent you was something like the Japanese are so damned hardcore. Like,
yeah,
holy cow. And in a very believable way, like if you know the Japanese historically in any way, even just from movies.
Yeah. I listen to, you know. I want to hear your thoughts, but I just want to tack on to that observation. I listened to a podcast that I'm sure I've mentioned before, but I don't think I've talked about at length, called Hardcore History, by yeah. mm-hmm. Dan Carlin. He makes these yeah. really long, it doesn't even like essay is not the right word for it, because he'll do a series on something. And this series was called something like Armageddon in the East or something like that. And it's basically the story of Japan from leading up to World War II all the way up through Hiroshima and Nagasaki and a little bit after that. It's mostly just the war. Because that's he talks about history, but it's all battle. Like, he did a whole series on the Battle of Thermopylae. That's 300, right? Spartans or Laconia. There's a different name for them, but so his stuff is mostly about battle and warfare and some of the politics that are necessary context to those things. But a thing that he said over and over, and he was quoting someone talking about the Japanese, is that they're like everybody else, only more so.
That's a way that I mean,
it's very reductive, but it's a way that I think about their culture, even like historically, like in the imperial, like sort of fascist state that they were in up to and during World War II, and the sort of democratic state. I mean, as far as I know, democratic, the freer society that they have now, and to see some of the things they do, you know, it's very polite, very respectful, but almost too much, right? Very,
yes.
Very fastidious, like keep their houses clean, but almost too much. Like everybody, you know, everyone takes off their shoes and they have, you know, slippers for guests and all of this kind of stuff, and a lot of it is really good, and then there are other things that you're like, oh, that's, I think you're taking that too far. So
can I give an example of the one that I got me?
Go ahead, continue. I just wanted to add that.
Falling off that vein, it's there's one scene, and I don't do this as a spoiler, but it's kind of just a part in the show where the main Japanese guy is. And I don't have names. It's only one episode in, so I got to remember right. names. He is, well, first off, he's one of the most like coolest actors in films. Mm. Anyway, he's played in a lot of them. If you Google who it is, he's kind of been insulted and attacked kind of by like political things. Mm-hmm. And he's got his men kind of off to the side, sitting down respectfully. And one guy can't handle it. And he steps forward, just one step, and then
right.
stands up for his lord, and is like, "No way! How dare you do this right thing?" And then the lord kind of backs him down, right? He's like, he doesn't say, "I'm going to say the bastardization of it," saying, "Chill out, man. It's all good, right?" And the guy says, "Okay, I'm sorry. Let me kill myself." Right. That's the extreme, right?
Yeah.
What you were just saying, like they're this. He's extreme. No. This is Japan. So he didn't just say, "Let me kill myself." He's like, "And my entire lineage, like all children, people, everything. Let me kill it for that little mistake. And Japan's like, accept this as an acceptable apology. And I'm like, it's what?
Yeah. and this that character's Toranaga. He's played by Hiroyuki Sanada, who
that's it. Yeah,
I didn't realize like he was in Westworld. He was in
he's
Avengers
so good.
Endgame. Bunch of stuff. And this series is set in the 17th century. It's the 1600s, right? So that's part of it, part of the context too. Like they still have this like honor, right? Honor and polite. Like his underling, whatever they call it, like you know, stepped up to defend his lord in an inappropriate way, right? In a way that breaks decorum and politeness and manners. And he's like, that was a shameful thing for me to do. You know, let me pay for it by killing myself and my entire family. Right. It's like,
that's the epitome of what you just said of
like them, honor and much, manners, you know? and politeness. We were talking about politics off the air and not decorum. You had a different word for it. Like what's acceptable behavior in context in a diplomatic meeting or something like that. And like, those are good things, right? Like manners and honor and valuing your reputation and all of those things, but taken to an extreme, like an extreme, extreme,
extreme, extreme.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, so, this first episode, there's a lot of that. Like, and I'm not saying it's intentional or over the top or there. Like, that's just part. What I really feel is that culture, especially at that time, and we can see that kind of stuff influence even to today in Japanese culture with the extreme things and how they take things as a culture. They do. It's one of the things it endears me to the Japanese people as so unique and interesting and wonderful type people, is the way they can just go to this other place of amazing stuff. I love the Japanese, big fan. So this one is their historical stuff. How do you take what we know of Japanese now and see that in a, you know, 1700s or the 1600s? That's what it's like. And they were still like that. And we see that even though with, you said like the extreme stuff, they don't just have thin wallpaper. Their walls are made out of like rice paper, very thin things that, you know, you're like, what the hell to make it fine and refined and beautiful and like, geez. So the show, that's just one part of something I've noticed. And it goes throughout the whole thing, this whole clash of Japanese culture. It would be a good film. I'm using my hands like, cause I'm really animated right now, but the show would be good on its own as just like a period piece for Japan. But what really pulled me in was I think his name's Cosmo Jarvis. I think is his name Cosmo. I can't think remember Cosmo Kramer. Cosmo Jarvis, and his last name is Jarvis from Iron Man. Cosmo Jarvis is the he's not Portuguese. He's English. The English guy.
He's English. Who's
on a boat. He's the pilot.
Blackthorn,
John Blackthorn. Yeah, I think it's his name.
Yeah, John Blackthorn. Oh, Cosmo Jarvis is the actor.
Yeah. Sorry, that's
John Blackthorn is the character's name. He's English, and he gets some Dutch sailors to take him looking for Japan. I'm sure I've described this several times because I've talked about it before. But at this time, nobody in Europe knows where Japan is or even whether it exists, except for the Portuguese.
Portuguese and Japan doesn't know that there's anybody else besides the Portuguese, right? And maybe the Spanish. I think
everything they know about the Western world, they've heard from the Portuguese. So probably a lot of inaccuracies.
Yes, right. And that's kind of the point, especially at this beginning, which I mentioned that. I just want to clear my Cosmo Jarvis thing was that I liked his performance so much that I watched the guy like, who is that guy? And his name was a cool name, Cosmo, like Cosmo Kramer and Jarvis.
Very, very stage name. He looks like it sometimes bothers me because he looks kind of dopey. But it really fits the character. Like he's here, and it's very, I mean, a lot of the story, at least at the beginning and really kind of continues through, is culture clash.
right? Like they, yes. both groups, which I'm sure is reflective of actual history, like England at the time in the 1600s, like almost everybody in Europe were imperial powers, right? Like that's part of, imperial and colonial powers. You know, that's why the Dutch were out there. They had colonies all over the place, and the clash of these cultures that have both have very strong values and very strong, like just practices and manners and mannerisms and all of those things, and view the other as savages, as barbarians.
Yeah, they absolutely do, right? And
yeah,
in the first episode, you clearly know the rest of the series is based around that, but the first episode, just having that culture clash made it so, I guess the word is attractive to me to watch it. This pulled me in with, sure, those two. And obviously they're doing a fantastic job of building the world of this Japanese world and what's happening there. That's the main story, the meat of this. But then having the, and there's a lot of films and series where they did, where they have the foreigner always comes in and interjects themselves in the scene. Right. That's kind of a thing. There are point person, you know, as Western viewers. But the actor was so good. The character's so interesting already in the first episode, how he's intelligent and definitely a leader, but then occasionally just slips into being angry, you know, or fed up type stuff. And he, even when he's a prisoner, he's like, he gets angry that he can't understand them, so he just starts cursing at him and calling him like terrible names and stuff. And I'm like, he's so impulsive. I love it. I absolutely, but intelligent, right? He's intelligent, yeah, but impulsive, which, what a great character thing, that, you know, you're not supposed to do this thing, but I just, the impulse is too strong to not do that. He kind of reminds me with that characterization of the sheriff in what's that, Deadwood.
Timothy Oliphant.
Yeah. Now his was anger. This guy's not necessarily angry, but that I know what I'm supposed to do and I'm intelligent, but sometimes I just, you know, just act on impulse type stuff.
Sure.
And this guy does that. So, and I love that you can hear you see the subtitles of what the Japanese are saying. So you know both sides of the conversation and are completely frustrated that if they could just talk to each other, it would be fine. But they can't. And it's compounded worse when there's an interpreter who has an agenda in the middle.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow, what can be worse in this situation than what's happening right now?
Yeah.
And then later on in the first episode, they get an actual interpreter that he shows and illustrates that he can be trustworthy. And when that happens, it just feels like a great weight is lifted off. And you're like, okay, finally, a conversation can be had here, you know, of something. Not that they're going to get along, but, you know, they don't think each other as barbarians, at least a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, which is pretty good. So yeah, that all happens. And by the way, that whole lineage thing goes even further to the extreme when they start talking about they have to sacrifice a brand new baby for it.
Right.
And you're like,
right,
geez, people, it just never ends. So yeah, it's really good, and it's definitely my kind of film.
I don't remember as of the first episode, have they introduced Anna Sawai's character yet?
I don't recognize that name.
The girl from Monarch.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I couldn't remember.
Oh, wait, no. That's his daughter, right?
No, but she's,
or in-law or some kind of, he's his family member, is that right?
She's I don't think she's related to him, but she is part of his like court, as they would say in Europe.
And she speaks Portuguese or something, right? Like yes, they have. Because she was there. That's why it made that communication work, is that there was a priest interpreting, and he did prove that he was doing the one-to-one, doing the right kind of interpretation. But the Lord Yoshi would look at her to verify what he said was right. interpreting as correct. Right. And I was like, that's a double check there.
Yeah.
Well done. So she was there. Yes. Yeah, and she's good so far. I'm assuming she's going to be a love interest for him because they feel like perfect.
You know, sure. Sure.
As characters already.
Yeah. It's interesting. I watched a YouTube, I want to say like Nerdwriter or one of those YouTube video essay channels, talking about how central like language and translation is to this series. It's an adaptation of a novel, and the novel was adapted before, like in the 80s. And what the showrunner did on the original adaptation was change the story to really immerse the viewer in John Blackthorne's Blackthorne. Immerse the viewer in his experience by not having subtitles. Right?
Okay.
So think about how different the show would be if anytime the Japanese characters are talking, you're in John Blackthorne's shoes. Like, you have no idea. You have to guess what they're talking about, what they're saying from their tone and their body language and their facial expressions and all of that. And just it, like, I think that's interesting, but so much of the story, like all the characters are Japanese except for him. And like a handful of others like Portuguese that you see in between.
Yeah.
And so you lose like all of their internality, like all of the, you know, the things that they say to each other and all that. It's really fascinating. But you, as it goes on, you get more of that, like what does John say? What is the translator? How does the translator translate that? And then what does Torunaga say? And how do they translate that back to him? It's you know, I mean, it's fascinating. And
yeah. I
love that kind of stuff.
There's two. I agree. Totally do. First off, I want to add that you're going to be disappointed in me because I watched it. I watched it like 1 or 2 in the morning, right? I just want to say that again. I watched it with dubs. I know. You're going to hate me forever. I'm in the doghouse for now. I get it. But it was late and my eyes were not the best to look across the screen. Sure. So like, I'll watch it with the dubs. And they were fine. But I also know Sonata. I can't remember. I get his first name. Hero something. Sonata. The main guy. Lord Yoshi.
Yeah.
He I know his voice. And his voice is like one of the best things of his acting performance. He's just really good. And putting a dub over that, just I know it wasn't him. And I know it would be better with his voice. So I was like, I recognized that it was a dub subpar, whatever. And I still really enjoyed it. The last two bits I wanted to say about this one, on the extreme thing, there was also they in the first episode, they show it again by again killing themselves. I think his name was Kashigi or something. He's the small owner of a fiefdom where the ship went shipwrecked. He was the lord there.
Okay, right.
And they go down to save Rodriguez from the rocks in the water, and he's fallen into the water and might die. So instead of like just fighting for his life, he kind of gives up and pulls his sword out, and he's going to kill himself.
I forgot about that scene. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, and that's one thing that Blackthorne finds very impressive, that he was going to go out on his own time. That's the first thing that endears him to these people, I guess, is that he was really impressed by that. And I was thinking, man, again, another example of Japanese extremism, that he'll kill himself rather than, and go out with honor.
Right.
Then let the rocks take him type stuff. Yeah. I'm like, man, if he just wait a second, they'll throw some rope down, dude. In which they did. spoiler. And the last thing I wanted to say was, and this has to do with casting as well. This one I looked up. I didn't know this one. I can't get this guy's name, but his name's Nestor Carbonell. He plays the mayor in the Dark Knight series. I remember him from Lost.
Oh yeah. That guy.
In this one, he plays Vasco Rodriguez, and I don't know if he's in the rest of the show, but he is fantastic.
He's like
in
that first episode. He's like a sort of pirate. I forgot about that guy.
Oh, don't tell me that, because he's great. That's a spoiler, because he's awesome. And I was hoping, like, he's in it midway through to the end of the episode, and I'm like, I like that guy, and I hope he's around for the rest of the show, but obviously he's not now.
There's just a lot of characters in this sure. show, and like I'm focused on trying to keep the Japanese characters distinct in my mind, aside from Torunaka.
Yeah, well, he Rodriguez is he's got a big beard, so you don't really he's like Nestor's a very handsome fella. And
right.
striking that notice him. And he's got a big scraggly beard in this.
I didn't mean I forgot him. Like, he's a memorable character. I mean, I didn't recognize him as the Batman movies. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. And I said I remember him from Lost.
Right.
But he has this big scraggly beard on. And so you don't see who he is. But I noticed his voice and the cadence that he speaks. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I know that guy. And he just plays that character so well. Because at one point he says, like, I know you're a pirate and I've got the proof and I'm going to give it to the guys as soon as they get there. And they pull out, like, he tries to hit him, pulls again. It was just a great scene. So I'm loving the directing, the production, the acting, and the writing is just on par with it's telling me a good story that I feel like I'm in part of that world. That if it wasn't like 3 a.m, I would have continued to watch the next ones. Right. So. I will definitely watch another one tonight because it's just a really cool thing I want to watch. So, yeah, there's a long time on this, but I'm assuming you're still liking it.
Yeah. I'm still, like, almost, like, the day or the day after they come out, I watch them, unless I forget and it's too late because I've watched them late, too, but I want to, you know, be awake for it.
Well, especially if you're watching with subtitles, you want to be able to.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm going to keep going with the dub, and here's why, is because there's so much, and there are so many characters, and there's so much there that we've talked about this before. Subtitles is reading a book with the actual visuals in the background, but it's really you're reading, and with occasional lookups, right? And there's nothing wrong with that, because I like reading books. But when you watch a film without them, you're watching the film, and then... there's the words is the processing it your own stuff is kind of part of that. So if I had subtitles on, I know I'm just going to be reading those subtitles and not paying attention to the actual actor or actress who is saying the things so that I can get better personalities.
It is hard. Like, I watch almost everything. I mean, I shouldn't say almost everything. I watch everything with subtitles. if they have them. And I watched one of the episodes on my projector and the bottom of the screen wasn't entirely sharp, and it was frustrating trying to, and I think that's probably exacerbating my issue telling the Japanese actors apart, that I'm reading all of it because I don't like to listen to stuff super loud. And if characters are, like mumbling or whispering or speaking, and then the sound will get loud, like that bothers me. And so I don't, keep stuff very loud, but I also don't want to miss anything anybody's saying if it's accented or something like that. Like, I want to be able to get all of that information.
That's a valid point for subtitles, and because I struggle with that one. For me personally, solution has been I'm the opposite. Obviously, we said this before, where I have subtitles off as first option, but when I run and encounter problems where there's sound issues like that or mumbling or I don't know what they say, I just stop it, rewind it, turn subtitles on, and see it.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I just do that. I know that's more and it takes you out of it and, you know, you stick with one. But my trade-off is that I think subtitles takes me out of it enough that I would rather not have it and then jump back into it when I need it, which happens, you know.
Sure.
Sometimes on movies once or twice in a film. I know I said two, but there was one last one here. This show's good directing. There was a scene, and this is when I went and got my sword. was where the Lord, the good guy Lord, his person, his guy or whatever, he sends off to get the barbarian and see about this ship, comes up onto this other kind of jerk Lord, and he says something like, the jerk Lord says something like, I want the ship for myself, or I deserve to have it because it's in my thing.
It's in my
and life or whatever. Yeah. And the good guy Lord's, I don't know, his number one or whatever, says, oh, I thought that you served our Lord. And as he did so, he just kind of moved his hand to his sword.
Mm-hmm.
Not like he was throwing, just kind of rested on there. And everyone behind him, all of his men, did it at the exact same time.
Yeah.
Not in a threatening way, like they were getting ready to pull it out. They just rested their hand on their sword at the same time.
Right.
And I was like, holy cow, that was cool.
It's like in a Western, and there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of overlap between Westerns and like Japanese,
yeah,
media like of that
samurai
era.
Samurai stuff.
Mm-hmm. When the guy like pushes back his coat, like his duster, to just show the pistol, he doesn't. He doesn't. It's just like
it's there.
Rattling the saber, as the British would say.
Yeah. And the guy got the message immediately, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, so well done. And that was a direct exchange. The guy said, okay, right, let's do this, and this is how they're going to do that. And like,
yeah,
that was really awesome. So yeah, anyway, great film. Gonna keep watching that one.
Nice.
Let's move to, since we're still on some film things, I got a couple stuff to talk about. Let's keep going with this and talk about our movie this week. Yes.
Cool. All right, this week we watched Beetlejuice. From 1988. It obviously directed by Tim Burton.
it's like definitive Tim Burton,
it's,
right?
It's the Burtoniest movie I've ever seen.
yes, well said.
Starring everyone: Alec Baldwin, Gina Davis, Michael Keaton, Catherine O'Hara, youngest ever Winona Ryder, Jeffrey Jones.
The Burtoniest Burton that they're ever Burtoned. And then he goes on to things like Coraline and other films with it, but this is his thing. Mm-hmm. So you hadn't seen this one before?
Nope.
I had, just to repeat my comments from last week, when I introduced one, said I personally did not think that this is like a milestone in cinema history of things that people must watch, but I had thought that it was fun and does have a lot of interesting, very stylish type way, or as our friend Fox called it, like goth type stuff, and it's for like that kind of goth stuff, and worth watching. But I you know, some people hold it like Fox holds Ghostbusters as a, you know, a thing that's all identifies them. I don't feel that way, at least hadn't, but I admired it. Sure. I watched it this week and kind of feel the same way. I really like it. I knew all the parts that I've seen it 100 times, but it's just quirky, you know, in its own way. As they say, the line is, I am strange and unusual. That mm-hmm. encapsulates the whole film, I
right.
think.
Yeah.
And then you throw in just some weird Michael Keaton, you know, just
yep.
completely weird into the middle of it. So I talked enough about it. Give me your thoughts on this thing from someone who's just watching it now. You can be brutal. It doesn't hurt me in any other way.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like
so. Likeable. So there... We've watched films that I have some like question marks or uncertainty as to why I was not allowed to watch them as a kid. This movie is not one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I were a parent now, if I were, you know, if I were a, as we say, secular parent with no like religious whatever, I don't think I would let a kid under like 13 or 14 watch this.
Yes. And, got some scary things to it.
and even that, like the whole thing is about death, and it's also like a bunch of the jokes are adult jokes, and I don't mean like locker room jokes. Like the whole thing with Catherine O'Hara's character turning this quaint Connecticut house into a gaudy 80s quote-unquote high fashion hellscape, it's like is completely lost on a kid watching this. And even that's even before you get to what are admittedly phenomenal special effects for 1988. Yeah. Right, like
this did have a feeling when I was effects, a kid of
costumes
too old for me.
Stop motion, like all this stuff, incredibly well done and incredibly disturbing, right? That's intentional.
Yeah. The afterlife worlds, particularly talk about those. Yeah.
Like, yeah. And it's, I mean, the only thing I would say in terms of like, you know, being a student of film history, the thing we used to say when we were doing the poster, right, like significant in the history of film, I think is the way I said it, is that it's very much a horror comedy. And I don't even know horror. Yeah. Like, it's not even tagged horror on IMDb. It just says comedy fantasy. But to have, like, monsters, and it's a haunted house, and they're ghosts, right? Like, it's got
and
all
they do
the...
a lot of, like, murder. Like, they're killing themselves a couple
yeah,
times.
Yeah, it's got all the trappings of horror, but it's 100% comedy. Yeah. And so, like, that is... I'm sure it's not the first time this happened, but... It definitely strikes that balance fairly well. For me personally, I thought it was fine. I did watch it a little sleepy to connect back to your Shogun thing. Mm-hmm. I went to Bloomington Thursday night for beers, and then we had dinner. And then I came back to Bedford because everybody had gone home. I was originally thinking I would stay the night, and I did not. I came back and I watched this movie.
God, you had been traveling then, even after that.
Yeah, and so I was a little tired, and I was like, "This is just weird and bizarre for the whole 90 minutes of it."
strange yeah. and unusual, right?
Yeah,
for sure.
And to see a lot of actors very young, like, you know, very young Alec Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin's so different, like how he looks.
He's so young, relatively young Catherine O'Hara. And I think this is one of Winona Ryder's first. First roles.
What one is of that? Her breakout that's, roles that's 20, with stuff.
Definitely breakout roles, like. Established her as she had done two things before this, but I watched a couple of YouTube videos and they said she was 17 when this was made and playing younger, of course, but and they talked about some of the casting, like from Who's the Boss, Alyssa Milano, and
wait,
they were like,
she was in this?
No, she was she was the alternate for the role that went on a writer play.
Oh, okay,
and they're like,
cool, yeah.
Oh, what might have been different if that, that casting
Lydia.
Had been, and they were like, the guy on the YouTube was like, you know, such different. And I'm like, they're not that different. Like, obviously Alyssa Milano's career has taken a different path where Winona Ryder almost always plays like weird characters like this. But that was interesting to me. And then this, Michael Keaton, he had done other, like, more normal parts, like Mr. Mom, we watched a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then went from this to Batman, right, for Tim Burton.
What a different,
Where in this movie, he's almost playing the Joker.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. I mean, randomness like crazy. Okay, let me ask you questions. What do you think of the afterlife scene when they go to the afterlife? Like that whole social worker thing and football players.
Oh, that part. Like that was funny, right? Like the football players are calling her coach. There's
coach.
There's a sort of fairy at reception. And that, like, that also, that whole sequence is humor for adults, right? Like,
yeah, that's what made me think of it when you
said
that.
Take a number and sit in this waiting room, and here's the weird. And then so many of the people in the waiting room, there's an unspoken gag that you have to piece together from the visuals of how they died, right? Like, the smoking guy is all burned. And the guy who leads him down the thing was clearly run over by a car or something because he's all flat.
He's hanging as he goes. It's so stupid.
Yeah, it's very it's very dumb.
And what he says, like, didn't he make a joke about that too? He's like, how am I looking? Because I feel a little flat or something like that.
Yeah, it's something like that. It's very gag. Slapstick kind of comedy.
And at the end when Beetlejuice is there sitting on the thing and he's like, you get the head shrunk thing and he does that stupid, oh, look, what's that? And changes the guy's ticket. He's got a little one. He's got a long thing like that. Yeah. So dumb, but so funny. Yeah. So stupid. I also like that like social workers are the ones that are maintaining all the stuff. Like it's suicides or social workers, some kind of thing that suicides all go down there. And she's constantly dealing with the football team and then there was like the time changing stuff and when they come back and the house is all changed. I've seen people's houses like they made their houses look like the Dietz's house when the mom had revamped it with the crazy sculptures and the floors and stuff. That was interesting. It's I don't know, it's every character I will say I liked are very unique. The dad is different than how they fit with the mom. And then there's Odo. And then there's Lydia's different. And yeah, they just every character is so interesting and unique. And then they use the Sandworm. Sorry, they used the Shai Halud in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Maker.
The Maker. Yeah. Which was, it's funny. I knew that worm from Beetlejuice. Like that's, it was a big thing of Beetlejuice. And then obviously it was before that, but and then they have it in a lot of other films too, but that's where I always remember that the big worm is from Beetlejuice. Yeah, I agree. I think it was a mid. I mean I'd give it a 7, seven, maybe seven and a half.
Sure.
It's not mid like 5. It's better than just average.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, great graphics for the time. Noticeable now, like when they go out, step out of the place. But
yeah, it looks like a late 70s album cover.
Yeah, right. Yes, right. Right. Well said. But I liked some of the things, like the snake when he turns into a snake from the banister things.
Mm-hmm.
Those are pretty cool. I appreciated how he got horny. He got spikes on him, and he actually literally became horny.
Right.
And they made the prostitute house, and I'm like, so just weird. The jokes were just so weird. But we continue to see Tim Burton films and now know that that's just him.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Like, so it makes sense now to see it.
What goes on in that guy's head?
Yeah. But to be fair, I will say for the Beetlejuice enthusiasts out there, this was the first time we see this from him. Right? Like you said, horror comedy. And we see that a lot now. There's a lot of people that and Tim Burton himself makes all those kind of films. It's why people like, Coraline or his other works. It was the first time.
One thing I did remember I was thinking about this earlier. One of the YouTube videos I watched it was clearly made long enough ago that the sequel from they said the studio and I've lost it again, but they ran through all of the times that there was almost a sequel, like within a year or two after this, Tim Burton wanted to do Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian,
What?
Where he would mix like the beach, those beach movies from the 60s, with German surrealism, I think. Just because it's absurd. Like, they're so completely different, and Beetlejuice was going to win a surfing competition and all this stuff. And then, and I think they were in the process of like getting a script, and he had committed Keaton and Jeff Jones, I've already forgotten his name. The family, the Beyer family, Catherine O'Hara, Jeff Jones, Winona Ryder, and of course Michael Keaton. And then the studio offered him full creative control on Batman Returns. And so he did that instead. And that made me think, when I was, I don't know, in my teens or something, I was went through a phase of getting old movies from the video store, and Batman Returns was one that my parents were like, oh, that's a, I don't know if you want to watch that one's kind of, I forget exactly how they described it, but like, you know, disturbing and gross, basically. Which was
very, very Tim Burton-y, right?
Yeah, very, very Tim Burton-y.
And for those there who are shouting, saying, I can't believe when I say Tim Burton, I'm saying Coraline and not Nightmare Before Christmas, because I don't personally give Tim Burton as much credit as for that film as some people. Because if you watch the, like, how the making of stuff are for that film, Nightmare Before Christmas, he was more advisor than director.
Oh,
there was other people that were directing. He was doing, and I want to say it was Batman that he was
working on Batman at the same time. Okay.
Yeah, he was doing something at the same time. So he would like fly in for big idea meetings, and then he was just the big idea guy. And then other people directed it and did the day to day and did everything with it and made all the decisions and stuff. And then they would, if they had any big questions, then they would run back to him and say, hey, we've got your meeting once every 3 weeks that we got with you. Here's the things to check on. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's called Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, but I don't give him personally. There's so many other people that deserve the credit more than he does for that.
Sure.
So anyway, that's my excuse for not bringing it. Because that's also, some people would say, a definitive Tim Burton film.
Right.
When maybe, but anyway. All right, so it's your week. What do you got for me this time?
All right. I am going to pull a recommendation that I was reminded of this past weekend. Our buddy Pete, recommended Blast from the Past.
Awesome.
This is Alicia Silverstone and Brendan Fraser. Yeah. I saw it, or at least was in a room where it was on. He and his family go into a bunker, right? When something happens that they think is the U.S. getting nuked.
Yep.
And then comes back out in the 90s or whenever this movie was made. And so he's been raised in a bunker with his parents for 20 years or whatever.
And I have not seen this one at all. Pete seemed stunned when we were talking about it at beers. On Thursday, he was like, yeah, you better add that to your list. And I was like, this feels weird. One, that I hadn't seen it, but I don't know. Back when he was doing like Encino Man and stuff, I was kind of the right age, but a little young. So, some movies, and I just had that feeling when you were talking about Beetlejuice, felt like some kids in my class were watching them, but I don't know if my mom would like me watching them.
Sure.
Movies, sure. Right? Like, I know kids when I was in, I don't know, beginning middle school were watching Porky's, and I was like, no way I'd be able to watch that show.
Right.
You know,
it's like that Nate Bargatze sketch. He talks about his parents and what he wasn't like. He's at a sleepover and they were going to watch Friday the 13th or something.
Yes.
He's like, right. I stood up and I said, I don't think I'm allowed to watch this. Like, I thought a bunch of kids would stand up with me.
That was the only one. Yeah. I get that feeling. And So some of those films like that they're not bad, especially looking at them now, and I would be totally fine watching them at that age. But but maybe not. When I'm a kid, we weren't supposed to talk about, you know, sex or anything when you're 13. Or maybe you were, you know, but it just depended from house to house on things.
Sure.
It was, and those films are made for teenagers, and who have been talking about sex for like forever, like a year, you know? Blast from the Past. Yeah. That's one I haven't seen fit into that thing. And it had Brandon Fraser in it, which he was with Pauly Shore type things. And I was like, never found that, you know, back then.
Yeah, I think when this came out, whenever I heard of it, it was probably, you know, The Mummy and maybe George of the Jungle, or like George, the movies I knew him from. I don't remember.
The Mummy was great, the first one, but
yeah,
the rest of his repertoire.
And I don't know. Oh, The Mummy was the same year. And
as this one, as Blast from the Past,
yeah, they're both in 99.
Okay, wow, that feels okay. I'm wrong on my timeline then, because I was saying like I was actually in college when this came out then.
Yeah, I was just graduating high school, so I could have seen it. And as I said, I think I was somewhere where it was on, but it wasn't, you know, there's nothing wrong with this one that it was, I don't think that it would have been objectionable.
Yeah.
Maybe I just didn't watch it. George of the Jungle was 97.
And that one was not good. So
it's pretty bad, yeah.
Okay. Blast from the Past. We'll watch that one next. Oh, okay. Do you want to we played a couple games at our friend weekend Eclipse party. And our buddy Trotsky tried to get he had two agendas for game selection. One is he wanted everybody in the world to play Dune Imperium with him, because it's like his super boner thing he's on now. Not badly. It's a great game, but you know, he's excited about it. Right. And the other one was the Eclipse themes games, which is, you know, cool.
Yeah.
So what did you play that you'd like to talk about a little bit? At least give your thoughts on.
We did not play Eclipse, which I don't think I would have played anyway because it's too long. The only new games I played were that Twilight Imperium and Blue
Twilight Moon. Imperium? You played Twilight Imperium?
Not Twilight Imperium. Dune Imperium. The games with Imperium in the name. Which I thought was fine. Like I might get the digital version and try it again. I lost badly. So, you know, there's that. But
it's never a happy experience.
It doesn't seem as tight as it is. Like, it's a game that only goes to 10 points. And so you get I think Twilight Imperium is the same way, but it takes you, you know, 3 rounds to get 1 point. But you only, you know, the worker placement, you only get a couple of actions, and you're sort of deck building, but not really. Like, you don't go through enough cards for it to really have that deck building feel. We've talked about that at length when you were playing it. So I might try it again in digital. It was fine. Blue Moon City, I know we played that. Did I play that with you?
Yep, we played that.
I honestly don't really remember that one.
That was the one where the you had the dragons and you had the tiles that when you completed them, they flipped over and gave you crystals.
Right. And like the tiles adjacent to your would give you more bonus. Yes. I like that one. That was fine. Like I wasn't blown away by it, but I didn't hate it either. It was a good complexity level for me.
I think in general that's a good review of that game, and why it's one of Sydney's favorite games. It's why we play it here, and why it's one to pull out, because it's a decent moderate complexity level. Well, not really. It's easy to moderate complexity level that has a timer, because there's only so many things you flip over. and goes quick and isn't hard to explain nor play, right?
Right.
But you have enough to make it a real game. Yeah, and I liked it for the reasons you just said. You know, it was good. It was enjoyable, and it never, and I even said time already, just never overstays its welcome.
Sure,
did the thing, got the crystals, built the obelisk or whatever, and it was over. Like, yeah, that was good. Which every time I've played it, it ends right there where you just need it to be. Any longer, it'd suck. Any shorter, you'd be like, not enough. So, yeah. What was the other ones we played? Last Light. I played Last Light. So,
yeah, I was not in the Last Light game, so I don't.
It's a big game. It was a 3-hour game. Lots of parts. If you might Google's Last Light board game, you will see it looks like it's a massive thing. You need a huge table to deal with it, yeah. Right? And we played it with 8 or 7 or something like that. It was like a lot of people. I will say, that being said, all those two things are usually real big negatives, like once a year type play, and you have to make a thing with it. This one is not so much because it is fully centered around simultaneous play. Everybody has the same 6 cards that are actions, right? There are 6 actions. You can take 1 card per action, and everyone has them and never gets more. So, and then you pick one, we all put our thumbs up, say I'm ready, and then we go 1, 2, 3, we turn them over, and then everybody takes their turn at the same time. So everything is happening with like 1 or 2 exceptions. When combat happens, then we kind of have to stop, and those 2 people who are fighting do the combat, which is very short either too. It's just rolling dice. You know, it's not that hard. So you are always engaged. It's a 2 to 3 hour game. And we intentionally had to take breaks so that we could go to the bathroom, because if you leave, everyone's waiting on you,
right.
Even to get a drink or something, because we're all playing together.
Yeah, I heard people describe it that way. It sounds exhausting.
A little bit was. We had some people at the table who can get overwhelmed, I guess, by things happening. When they were happening all at the same time, and the board changes because it has this mechanic where it literally spins spots, so it's area control, but those areas move around, and it feels a little unpredictable sometimes, intentionally. But those people who like to know what's going on, all the things, really couldn't, because we weren't taking turns one person at a time, figuring out what they did, then taking the time to think about how to counter that or whatever. We weren't looking at everybody's cards to know what they had to potentially think about what they could do next. It was just happening at the same time. So if you're one person that has to know everything that's going on, you just can't. You just can't. You just play your game and go forward. That's what you do. And if it changes, well, then it changes. And you have to be okay with that, which I thought was fine. Because that's how I prefer to play games anyway. It kind of brings it down to me when I try to think too much of overthinking everything, and I get analysis paralysis and stuff. But I didn't get analysis paralysis because we really couldn't. We just, you know, you're not playing really fast, but you're still everybody's waiting on you to go so we can all play, which was pretty good. But anyway, it was fun. Lots of pieces, very cool. It did fit the theme with planets and stuff going around. It's got little ships. I do recommend, I didn't give a real good review of the game right now, but I would recommend it. We are going to play it again. Now that we know how to play it, it'll probably take 2 hours and we can play it in a normal game night. It's just tear down and break up. Pulling it out is a big ordeal. I do recommend it. So go look up Last Light and see some of the components. They're very good components. Very cool looking. Lots of little ships, like miniatures that are unique to you. They do have stuff like there's different alien races that you play that make it supposed to make it different for each player, but they really don't. So every person kind of plays the exact same thing with very minor difference in your race choice. That's not terribly significant. Right. So every game isn't different in that way. Next time we play the same kind of things. Even if you pick a different character, it's not going to change it much. But yeah, I liked it.
Cool.
Thumbs up. What do we got on here? You wanted to talk about, what is this, Saturday Night Live Ticket to Ride?
Oh, yeah. That's just really briefly. Trotsky Fox and I watched SNL Saturday night. And the first sketch after the monologue was a group of friends at a dinner party, and one of them pulls out Ticket to Ride, which, of course, the two of them just lost their minds over.
Oh, of course. Are you sure they weren't playing Jumanji? No.
The gag was Jumanji. Kristen Wiig was hosting, and her character doesn't play board games because she's afraid of getting Jumanji'd. And they just go around.
Which is fantastic.
It's very funny. Right? I'll link it in the show notes if you haven't seen it, but it's on YouTube.
Yeah. The whole bit of the disagreement between whether you go out of Jumanji when you play Jumanji, the game comes into the real world,
or you go into the game world, and then they make a joke about the new movie.
And the fact that the game itself is called Jumanji. So, like, when playing Jumanji, you go into Jumanji.
They just say Jumanji over and over.
It's totally funny. The thing is, when they're saying it, I can follow along with it.
Yeah,
like, I knew what they were saying.
It's like a real nerd conversation.
So, but it was cute. I know those guys love Saturday Night Live. So,
right. Yeah.
Well, I think we got it all this week, man. Yeah. We did good.
Covered all the things. You've been listening to The Front Porch. This is episode 344. It has two fours in it, so throw me off. 344. Thanks as always to our friends at LRM Online. You can check them out for reviews on things. If you want to reach out to us and tell us why Beetlejuice is the greatest movie in the history of cinema, you can do that via email. Our address is frontporchpod@gmail.com, or you can go to our website, frontporchpodcast.com, where you will find contact forms to reach out to us. I'll also put links to everything that we talked about, movies and games, so you can check those out there. If you enjoy the show, please consider subscribing on the podcatcher of your choice. And while you're there, if you would leave us a 5-star review, we appreciate that. It helps out a lot in the rankings. As always, thanks so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Dennis.
And I'm Michael.
For The Front Porch.
Night, everybody.
See you next time.